कुंज बिहारी जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी जय गोपी जनवल्लभ केरिवर धारी जय गोपी जनवल्लभ केरिवर धारी जय जसोर नंदन गज जन यसोर नंदन गज जन जमुन तीरा भान चाहिया जमुन तीरा भान चाहिया राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी कुंज बिहारी हे राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी कुंज बिहारी हे गोपी जनवल्लभ गिरिवर धारी गोपी जन गिरी हे गोपी जनवल्लभ गिरिवर धारी गोपी जन गिरी जसोर नंदन ध्वज जन यसोर नंदन ध्वज जन जमुन तीरा भान जमुन तीरा भान जमुन हे ध्याय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी जय प्रभुपदा प्रभुपदा शिव प्रभुपदा प्रभु प्रभुपद प्रभुपद प्रभुपाद जय प्रभुपाद श्रीला प्रभुपाद की जय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय So this is Canto 4, Chapter 11, Swayambhuva Manu addresses Dhruva Maharaj, text number 3, 4, and 5, and we'll read chapter number 5. Satam prasakka abidvanto mirde. Nikritya bahuru sira dauro daran. Ninaya lokam param arkamandalam. Rajanti nirvidyayam urdhva retasaha. Satam prasankayar abidvantvato mrde. Nikritta bahuru siradaro daran. Ninaya lokam param arkamandalam. Vrajanti nirvidyayam urdhva retasaha. Satam prasankai abidvanvato mrde. Nikrita bahuru siradaro daran. Ninaya lokam param arkamandalam. Vrajanti nirvidyayam urdhva retasaha. Ladies,
Satan prasakte ravidhavato mridhe nikritta bahu rushiro dharo dharan ninaya lokam paramarka mandalam Vrajanti nirvidhyaya murdhvare tasaha. Satam prasakte ravidhavato mridhe. Nikritta bahu rushiro dharo
Sa, he, Dhruva Maharaj, Tan, all the Yakshas, brought Prasatkai by his arrows, Abhidvanvata, coming forward, Mirde, in the battlefield, Nikrita, being separated, Bahu, arms, Uru, thighs, Siradhara, necks, Udaran, and bellies, Ninaya, delivered, Lokam, to the planet, Param, supreme, Arkamandalam, the sun globe, Rajanti, go, Nirbidya, piercing, Yam, to which, Urvaretasaha. Those who do not discharge semen at any time. So we'll read verses 3 and 4 and then do the purport on number 5. Even as Dhruva Maharaj fixed the weapon made by the Narayan Rishi onto his bow, arrows with golden shafts and feathers like the wings of a swan flew out of it. They entered the enemy soldiers with a great hissing sound, just like peacocks enter a forest with tumultuous crowing. Anybody can make that sound?
Yeah.
That's not so good, is it? Arrows sounding like that, that's pretty nice. Those sharp arrows dismayed the enemy soldiers who became almost unconscious. But various yakshas on the battlefield, in a rage against Dhruva Maharaj, somehow or other collected their weapons and attacked. Just as serpents agitated by Garuda rushed towards Garuda with upraised hoods, all the yaksha soldiers prepared to overcome Dhruva Maharaj with their upraised weapons. Translation for number 5. When Dhruva Maharaj saw the yakshas coming forward, he immediately took his arrows and cut the enemies to pieces. Separating their arms, legs, heads, and bellies from their bodies, he delivered the yakshas to the planetary system, which is situated above the sun globe, and which is attainable only by first-class brahmacharis who have never discharged their semen. Purport. To be killed by the Lord or by his devotees is auspicious for the non-devotees. The yakshas were killed indiscriminately by Dhruva Maharaj, but they attained a planetary system attainable only for brahmacharis who never discharged their semen. As the impersonalist jnanis, or demons, killed by the Lord attain brahmaloka, or satyaloka, persons killed by a devotee of the Lord also attain satyaloka. To reach the satyaloka planetary system described here, one has to be elevated above the sun globe. Killing, therefore, is not always bad. If the killing is done by the Supreme Personality of Godhead or his devotees, or in a great sacrifice, it is for the benefit of the entity killed in that way. Material so-called non-violence is very insignificant in comparison to killing done by the Supreme Personality of Godhead or his devotees. Even when a king or a state government kills a person who is a murderer, that killing is for the benefit of the murderer, and thus he becomes cleared of all sinful reactions. The important word in this verse is urvaretasaha, which means brahmacharis who have never discharged semen. Celibacy is so important that even though one does not undergo any austerities, penances, or ritualistic sermons, ceremonies prescribed in the Vedas, if one simply keeps himself a pure brahmachari, not discharging his semen, the result is that after death he goes to Satyaloka. Generally, sex life is the cause of all miseries in the material world. In the Vedic civilization, sex life is restricted in various ways. Out of the whole population of social structure, only the grihasthas are allowed restricted sex life. All those others refrain from sex. The people of this age especially do not know the value of not discharging semen. As such, they are variously entangled in material qualities and suffer an existence of struggle only. The word Uddhava Retasa especially indicates the Mayavadi sannyasis who undergo strict principles of austerity. In the Bhagavad Gita 8:16, the Lord says that even if one goes up to Brahmaloka, he again comes back, Abrahma Bhuvanaloka, Purna Arvritir Jurna Arnorjuna. Therefore, actual mukti or liberation can be attained only by devotional service, because by devotional service one can go to Brahmaloka or to the spiritual world from wherefrom he never comes back. Mayavadi sannyasis are very proud of becoming liberated, but actual liberation is not possible unless one is in touch with the Supreme Lord in devotional service. It says, Harim Vinaya Na Sritim Taranti. Without Krishna's mercy, no one can have liberation. Om Agyan Timirandasya Gena Jena Salakaya Chaksu Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobistam Staptitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadanti Swampadantikam Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Prastaya Bhutale Srimakti Bhakti Vedanta Swami Iti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pacharine Nirvishesha Shunyavari Pashtyatya De Satarine Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadara Sivasiri Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So, when Arjuna on the battlefield wanted to practice nonviolence, Krishna called him a pandita, asocham, avasocham, stad, pratyabharam, syabhasase, gatasum, zakudatum, cha. Panditas, pandita samadars, banana so shanti panditaha. There's pandit. Pandit means one who's learned, who knows things as they are truthfully. And then there's the apandit, and it's just the opposite. Arjuna, although a great devotee of the Lord, was acting in a different way, and therefore, he was a warrior. His duty was to fight, and there was a reason to fight, because the party on the other side had usurped the kingdom on what we say illegally, and it was persecuting those persons who were actually destined to receive the kingdom. And so there was every reason to fight, and besides that, and the real reason, the Supreme Personality of Godhead was on the battlefield and wanted to the Pandavas to have the throne. But Arjuna was thinking, you know, there's my friends, there's my relatives, there's my well-wishers, there's my martial guru, there's my grandfather, everybody who I have grown up with, learned from, actually love, relatives, friends, they're all on the other side. So, and then he came up with so many arguments for not fighting. One of the arguments is that even if we win, how can we be happy if we kill people who are dear to us? So, but Krishna spoke this verse, you don't know what actual knowledge is, and at the same time, you're shirking from your actual duty. And Krishna then, of course, that was the whole basis by which the principle of bhakti was explained, using that principle of what is the most important duty in life is to obey the orders of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and act on his behalf. But Arjuna had other reasons. And therefore Krishna told him, you're not very intelligent. And before he said that, he said, you speak nicely. I mean, we sometimes see that people can speak very nicely. But at the same time, the words really have no meaning because what they're saying has no value. Or it's self-motivated in order to present themselves in a certain way, to gain something, something from their activities. So it's self-motivated, it has nothing to do with benefiting others. People do that, they use others to gain things, something from their self. And that is called fruitive activities. Or acting in a way that one sees themselves as the center. And Arjuna was seeing that in the same way. Although he was righteous in some of his arguments, it didn't fit the situation. The situation was different. Krishna wanted him to fight and become the glorious hero that would bring about religious principles and the establishment of saintly rule throughout the world. And so here, Prabhupada makes this point. He says that, you know, those who speak about nonviolence, there was this one, what was it? He was a devotee, also somewhat of a devotee of the Lord. And no, this was another point. Okay, there was this one person who extolled nonviolence as his principle in life. He was speaking around the world about the principle of nonviolence. He kept a very strict principle of nonviolence in all aspects of his life. So one reporter wanted to challenge him. So he said to him, "My dear sir," this man also had two daughters. He said, "If someone comes and violates your daughter, in other words, attacks her and tries to, you know, accost her, what would you do?" He challenged him in that way, giving him a false situation, but just to see how he would respond. So the nonviolent proponent said, "In no situation will I become violent." And then the reporter said, "My dear sir, you are violent." To fail to protect those who require protection is not nonviolence, it's another form of ignorance, and therefore others become exploited when one can stop or has the duty to protect others. So we see here that sometimes people extol nonviolence. Nonviolence is one of the highest principles of spiritual life, but that nonviolence is based on the principle of what is actually religious principles. So real nonviolence means not to cause any difficulty or harm to any living entity, either through body, mind, or words. But there are those who need to meet justice. And that's why we have a system of justice. And those who violate others are required to get some punishment. And it says in the Manu Samhita, and people don't like this, but this is actually true, that if a person kills another person, then they have to be killed in order to make retribution for the activities that they perform, and at the same time stop their activities of not killing, and at the same time free them from the reaction of killing. We have this situation, it was just in the news about a week ago, where one one crazy man, he, with a knife, was running around London stabbing people. He killed two people, injured a few more, and then eventually he was killed by the police. But the situation was the man had already committed a violent crime before, and he was put in jail, and they let him out. So because they let him out, two other people were killed, and then again, there was a whole scenario of violence and. So therefore, it says here that if a state or a government kills a murderer, actually, that killing is for the benefit for the person. It stops them from performing further activities in the same way, and at the same time, it relieves them of the reaction. It says that if you kill someone in your last life, and then you haven't been retributed, in this life you will suffer tremendously from that reaction. And you won't know why. You can't remember what you did in the last life, but you get all kinds of suffering. It says people get, so many legal problems in their life, they can't even understand why. I had one good devotee friend. He was always getting blamed for everything that he didn't do. He's a wonderful devotee. He's still going today. And so at one point in his life, he was wondering, well, why is that? He's always getting... So they had a little astrological reading, and the astrology was good. He said, "In your last life, you got credit for things you didn't do." So in this life, you're getting the reaction in the opposite way. So, you know, karma is very strict, the laws of karma. If you read the scriptures, especially Garuda Purana, it really explains how tightly controlled the living entity is in all situations. And one cannot act independently in any case. We have free will, but that free will is controlled by either the material energy, or if we put ourselves under the control of Krishna, then we actually have free will, because that free will is the nature of the soul's relationship with Krishna. But even if you are under the material energy and you think, "I have free will," you're destined by your karma, and you're also by the type of desires that you have. So you're locked up. Sometimes people say, I want to change my life, but I can't. Before you can change your life, you have to change your desires. Because if your desires are the same, sometimes devotees wonder, I keep getting the same reaction. Yeah, because you're doing the same thing. I don't want the same reaction, I don't want the same results, but we're acting in the same way and we want something different. It just doesn't work. You have to change not only the activity, you have to change the consciousness that produced the activity. Like I just got a letter, I know with this one person, this person is suffering from some illness. And so they're going to doctors and some medical things, and I realize it's not going to do any good. What it requires is a lifestyle change. As soon as there is a lifestyle change, then the doctors will have some effect. Otherwise, the doctors will not be able to save or help that person because the lifestyle is not changing, is not being changed. So a lot of times it's not about the activity, it's about the consciousness that produces the activity and about shifting away from that consciousness and developing the proper consciousness which changes the activity. And gradually the results automatically change with them. So Dhruva Maharaj is a Kshatriya, and he's acting a little bit beyond his, what we say, duty. He's a little bit vengeful. His brother was killed by a Yaksha, one Yaksha, so he's now annihilating the whole tribe of Yakshas. And he's powerful. He's empowered by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He's a pure Kshatriya, and the Yakshas are also Kshatriyas. So this is an interesting fight. Somebody should make a movie of this. This would be really exciting to see Dhruva Maharaj fighting with the Yakshas, because both of them are really good fighters on both sides. I mean, we should, maybe next year when they do the Bhaktivedanta, not Bhaktivedanta, but when they do the plays here in Mumbai, they can do this one. This would be interesting. But therefore, at one point he has to be restrained from his activities, and that will come up. So that restraining comes by the leader of the Yakshas, Kuvera. And then now, but what is happening is a great fight. And it mentions that because they're being killed by a great devotee in a battle, these Yakshas, they're getting a very high state of what we say material destination in their life, in the next life. They actually are elevated to the level of Satyaloka. It says here, Prabhupada makes this point and also reverts this verse to this particular point as the essence of the verse, where he says that brahmacharis, those who practice real brahmachari, throughout their whole life and never discharge any semen, automatically, even by that process of brahmachari, can elevate themselves all the way up to Satyaloka or Brahmaloka. So that's all powerful. Therefore, austerity is the basis of the principle of bhakti. It says there are four kinds of wealth. The wealth of money, which is the lowest form of wealth. Higher than that is the wealth of knowledge, which is a higher form of wealth. If you have knowledge, then you can do things, and you can also free yourself from suffering. But higher than the wealth of knowledge is the wealth of austerity, which brings about both intelligence and knowledge, I mean, and also great physical and mental power. But austerity leads to bhakti. Austerity, and when the austerity is governed by religious principles, that's why Krishna mentions austerities in the 17th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Austerities of the mind, austerities of the body, austerities of speech. But in austerities of the body, one of the principles is celibacy. So celibacy sometimes is seen in two different ways, or understood in different direction. I remember we were organizing a conference for brahmacharis many years ago. Myself and another senior devotee were putting together brahmachari conferences in different places. And so I was advertising the conference as celibacy for those in the celibate order, and many ladies wanted to come to the conference. And I said, it's not for ladies. They said, well, we're celibate too. Although we're married, we're practicing celibacy. Then I realized I used the wrong word. It's not, and so I had to go back. It was just for the within the brahmachari, because celibacy is both within the grihastha, or all the four ashrams can practice celibacy if they follow their religious principles. As Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, sex life that is not contrary to religious principles, that's me. Bhaktisiddhanta Prabhupada would quote his Guru Maharaj by saying that Bhaktisiddhanta would say, if I could do it, I would have 100 children in married life. But because he wasn't married, that wasn't his, what we say, dharma, to produce so many children. But he was making the point that in grihastha life, that if one is producing Krishna-conscious children, and it mentions that with the desire to make them Krishna-conscious, then, and following the principles of conception according to the direction of the spiritual master. Just like sometimes if people don't know the Shastras, and people come up, some of disciples or others come up and say, oh, you know, my wife is pregnant. I said, did you get permission from your spiritual master? They said, no. I said, good luck. Because it mentions in the seventh canto that before one should engage in bringing children into the world, one has to get permission from one's spiritual master. This is the whole purport, Prabhupada makes that point. That permission comes, along with permission comes blessings. And with blessings, then there's more of a guarantee that embryo, but that child will be a very elevated soul that takes birth in that womb. So, and sometimes I see when people don't do that, the child is a little different, a little more like on the rascal side. So, you know, yeah, so we always have to get blessings from the spiritual masters, especially in that area. And people don't know it. It's only one purport. It's in the seventh canto, chapter 12, verse number 11. I think it is. Prabhupada very extensively explains that those in married life and who want to conceive child, which is the duty of those in married life, then they first need to get permission from the spiritual master. And that permission gives blessings, and blessings means auspiciousness. And auspiciousness means then there's good fortune. So, but then again, those in brahmachari life, it mentions here, should very carefully, strictly avoid all kinds of contact with the opposite sex. And if one can do that very carefully and execute devotional service, there are those who are proud of being brahmachari, but they're not so much fixed in what we say devotional service. There was one, one of my spiritual master godbrother was talking to one of his disciples. He came, he was telling his spiritual master, he said, you know, I was just like Haridas Thakur. My old girlfriend, she called me up the other night and she wanted to meet me. So I said, yeah, I'll meet you. And it was, she wanted to meet me in the evening. So I said, yeah, okay, you can meet me. And I was thinking, I'm going to pray to Haridas Thakur and I'm going to chant. And I'm going to sit there and I'm not going to be disturbed at all the whole night. So the girl came and they were conversing and he was chanting the best he could and praying. And somehow through the whole night, and then finally she left. You know, she tried to come and seduce him, but it didn't work. So he was so proud. The next morning he went to his spiritual master and he told him, I made it. His spiritual master said, what a fool you are. You didn't make anything. You can't imitate Srila Haridas Thakur and expect to get the same result. Where was your mind? Where was your mind? So yeah, so if the mind is not fixed on a higher principle, even though you don't perform the activity, still that is another form of what we say sense gratification. And Bhagavad Gita also explains that one who is outwardly very austere but inwardly thinking of sense gratification is called what? pretender and pretender. So the way we can get over this pretentious consciousness is that one has to chant the holy names of the Lord with great relish and with determination and develop a taste for chanting. Then one is not disturbed by the situation, even when disturbing. There was one story with Srila Prabhupada. I use Prabhupada as an example, but there are many other examples. Where Prabhupada was in New York, and he had come from an airplane trip, and he was in the terminal. And the devotees were a little enthusiastic in those days to want to greet Prabhupada in the best possible way. So many times they would bring the Vyasa-san to the airport. And then his big costly Vyasa-san, carried by six people, put it in a van and bring it to the airport for Prabhupada to sit on. So this is how the devotees would like to greet Prabhupada. And Prabhupada, later on he would say it's not necessary, but when it happened, he would accept it. So he came and he sat on his Vyasa-san. And there were some reporters there who had come to meet Prabhupada and ask questions. So one reporter was a little envious of Prabhupada sitting on this Vyasa-san. And so he couldn't retain his enviousness, and it came out in the form of a question. So he said to Srila Prabhupada, Swamiji, why do you have to sit on that fancy seat? A very challenging question. And Prabhupada could have answered the question in many different ways, but he decided to smash this reporter. So, and there were other reporters around. So he said, well, and the difference between you and me is I can be in a room full of naked women and not be disturbed. And so his colleagues all started to laugh when they heard Prabhupada's response. In other words, he became somewhat embarrassed by his question. And Prabhupada put him in his place. Prabhupada was saying that, when one is engaged in devotional services and fixed in devotional service, and then happiness and distress, honor and dishonor, he didn't call attraction and renunciation or attraction and aversion all the same. So one has to practice very carefully the process of devotional service and rise above the attachments that come by way of the external environment in this form of so many various types of subjects like that. And then one can only do that, as Prabhupada was talking this morning, I was listening to him in one lecture, he was talking about, the only way you can control your mind is fix the mind on the lotus feet of the Lord in devotional service. He says so many people try to control their mind by various types of programs and principles and restrictions and diets and this and that. Of course, there are things that support mind control that devotees must practice, such as, if you're eating late at night and you're eating a big feast, you can expect there might be some trouble in the night or even the next morning you might find your japa is all over the place. So therefore, one of the things that we shouldn't do is eat large amounts of foodstuffs in the evening. If you have to eat in the evening, something simple, something light, and that way it doesn't interfere with sleep. But sometimes we find that we get these huge feasts at night, and then what happens? And then it becomes very difficult to control the mind and senses. Or if one is talking nonsense throughout the day or talking unnecessarily throughout the day, it becomes very difficult to control the senses and mind when you try to. Because the more you go the wrong way, the harder it is to go the right way. The more you go the right way, the easier it becomes after some time. The initial experience, just like Prabhupada would use the example of a tiger in a cage. So the tiger is being, in order for them to tame that tiger in the zoo, the tiger is ferocious. He's just been captured, now he's part of the zoo, and he's very ferocious. So what they do is they don't feed the tiger for one day, and then he becomes more ferocious. And then they don't feed him a second day. In other words, they starve him until he becomes so weak that his ferocity becomes less and less, and he's like a, a gigantic pussycat. And then they can start to work with the tiger and start to train him easier like that. Prabhupada would use that example. So if you're used to feeding your senses, then when you stop feeding your senses, it becomes more and more difficult. But then again, just by stopping, that's not enough. One has to take up the positive activity of devotional service and replace that. And gradually, even though it may be difficult in the beginning, if one stays, Jai Sisi Radha Vrindavan Bihari Ji Ki, if one stays fixed in the principle, gradually one develops a higher taste and one sees, as it says, Jamunacharya would say, he was a king. He was in a royal position. He had so much facility for sense gratification, and he used that. Finally, after being in that position for many, many years, prior to that, he was a great devotee when he was a young boy. His spiritual master devised a trick to bring his disciple back. That trick worked, and finally he gave up his kingdom and actually again became a great acharya, a great devotee, and later the spiritual master of Ramanujacharya. But when he actually became again fixed in pure devotional service, he recites, Prabhupada recites that verse, that when he mentions that when I think about sense gratification in the form of sex life, my lips curl in disgust and I want to, Prabhupada said, spite on it. He wants to, he becomes disgusted. So what is so pleasurable and attractive, and people actually kill each other for it in this material world, and that is to enjoy sex life, the devotee who is fixed in consciousness has no taste for that anymore and sees it as simply just something that is very, what we say, undesirable, or, and of course, absolutely unnecessary. So, therefore, the higher taste comes from becoming fixed in Krishna consciousness. And that starts with seriously chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. Prabhupada, when he gave out sannyas in the early days to many of his disciples, he gave them to devotees who are not always on the highest platform. But he said, if you can control your mind and senses and seriously chant the holy names of the Lord, then you can remain fixed in your sannyas ashram. Prabhupada took a chance because he knew some of his disciples who wanted sannyas and others who he gave sannyas were not ready for that ashram, but he gave it anyway. But he gave the formula how they could remain fixed in their responsibilities in their ashram. He said, therefore, very carefully chant the holy names of the Lord and develop a higher taste through chanting. And then you will not be distracted or attracted by the allurements that come from in contact with the opposite sex. But we see that that always didn't work. Prabhupada made 53 devotees, sannyasis, 40 of them, didn't maintain their ashram out of 53. So that was Kali Yuga. Kali Yuga was very strong. But many of them stayed in Krishna consciousness and became wonderful grihasthas and started to preach wonderfully. So, but the point is, in any ashram, celibacy is required. I get a lot of letters, not so much. I think it's changed now, but for years ago, especially from grihasthas, I can't follow that fourth regular principle. It's too hard in married life. The temptation is too much there. And besides, you know, it either comes from one side or the other. If I don't satisfy my husband, he'll go out and do it anyway, so I have to do that, and we have to break the principles. And I don't want to do it, the wife cannot control and she's alluring the husband. So what do you say to that? These are initiated devotees. Or sometimes when a person is really fixed in Krishna consciousness and been practicing very hard, but they're married and they're not initiated yet and they want to be initiated and they're doing everything But they can't follow that fourth principle. What do you do? It's a problem for those who give initiations. So these things are coming up. So this, what do you call it? Material adiras. Because what is this material adiras? It's the spiritual adiras and the perverted reflection. This desire, which comes in the form of lusty desires to enjoy sense gratification in a gross way, that energy is actually the pure energy of the soul's love for Krishna. When it's diverted back towards the source of its existence, that is Krishna in pure devotional service. I say pure devotional service. I doesn't mean that person have to be pure, but you can practice pure devotional service even if you're not pure. That means if you follow carefully the principles of devotional service according to the instructions of the spiritual master, with determination you're executing pure devotional service, although you may have not reached the state of pure consciousness yet. So if we practice that way, then one can somehow or other stay aloof. And then even if one is in the arena where there is temptation coming from the external environment, one is not disturbed. One is not disturbed. And one is, so therefore, but one cannot imitate that. One cannot, I told that story about that one devotee trying to imitate Haridas Thakur. He thought he was successful. His spiritual master called him a big fool. So therefore, even being changed in mind is another form of fall down. Because ultimately, we have to keep our mind engaged in devotional service nicely. So therefore, one should practice devotional service with determination. And the most important part of our devotional service, as the foundation for everything else we do, is hearing and chanting the glories of the Lord. When one is sufficiently hearing and chanting the glories of the Lord, as it says, Satam prasangam mama virya sambido, Bhavanti Ritkarna Rasayana Katha. Then one can develop a higher taste just by hearing and chanting the glories of the Lord. And as it says, Visayan Vinivartante Niharasya Dehinam Raso Vyarjam Vaso Pyasya Param Drisva Nivartante. Then we have to go for that higher taste. Otherwise the lower taste becomes strong. Prabhupada used to say, Maya is as strong as you are weak. Maya is as strong as you are weak. So Maya's strength really is really in proportion to how much we are still attracted by Maya like that. But one who practices devotional service seriously, and here mentions in the Brahmachari Ashram, those who never discharge them, and that, I mean, that's a very rare personality. It's called Urva Retasa. That means from the very birth. But those of us who were born in Western countries, that was never taught or never practiced. In fact, the opposite was always encouraged. So therefore, but one who comes to Krishna consciousness and practices that celibacy from that point on, still can become elevated to the position of pure consciousness and be free from this attachment like that. So here, yeah, that's the point that's being made, the importance of austerity and restriction and sex life. In any of the ashrams, the celibacy is one of the highest principles because it allows the mind to become fixed more and more on the lotus feet of the Lord. When the mind is diverted to other things, then one cannot taste the sweetness of Krishna consciousness. Okay, any questions, comments? Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, thank you for the very straightforward presentation on a very sensitive
controversial topic.
Sensitive topic. Maharaj, in our presentation of Krishna consciousness, this principle of celibacy comes across many systems of philosophy also. But people get turned off when we talk about concepts like celibacy, So in our presentation, if we are restricting it to just saying that, okay, especially celibacy within the grihastha ashrama, people are totally bewildered by that whole concept. So in our presentation of our philosophy, if we just restrict it to just say loyalty between, or no adultery, just loyalty within the ashrama, if we just restrict it that way, is it diluting Krishna consciousness versus just telling them the blatant truth and repelling them from Krishna?
We don't push people who are can't following. We encourage them, we give them all facilities, we consider them devotees, everything. But we say you have to work on that one. Because it is diluting the actual principle. Because they don't have that higher taste, still the lower taste is still there. Or the desire to engage in the lower taste. When you get the higher taste, then you have to go for that higher taste. And in the meantime, you have to restrict yourself from the lower taste. So we don't find any statement in the Shastra or by the Acharyas that allows for compromise. The only principle that we, or the only point we make is that these persons who are not following all the four regulative principles in grihastha life should not be considered to be low class, condemned, criticized. They should be given all facilities and considered to be devotees in the right. Sometimes when we find out, then we start to find some fault with that. Don't find fault, but realize they have something to work on. And that's all. You have to work on that. I mean, I get letters like, if I don't satisfy my husband, he's going to go to the prostitute. So what am I going to do? So that's the woman doesn't want to break the principles, but she doesn't want her husband going outside either. So what do you do? Anybody gotten suggestions for that one? So, I mean, it takes some discussion, some counseling, like that. But you can't really adjust the principles in order to accommodate a lower level. Because Prabhupada said, and he said it over and over again, the basis of our movement is based on the following these four regulative principles and chanting 16 rounds. Anything less than that, and then our movement will actually become gravitate down. So just another movement in the world, as you know, a nice religious movement that came and went. But our movement is not like that. It's for purifying the whole world, and therefore this is the basis for the process of Krishna consciousness. But we need to encourage people to go for that higher taste and arrange programs where they can have that opportunity to get the higher taste. Yeah.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. Maharaj, where do you draw the line between emphasizing on this principle and at the same time trying to avoid committing the ninth offense of instructing a faithless person? So is it that when someone we may have to wait till that person gets sufficient trust and faith and then we...
Yeah. Prabhupada never spoke the four regulative principles at the beginning. He spoke mostly chanting Hare Krishna, taking prasadam, engaging in devotional service. And gradually as people become more and more familiar and start reading our books, then we gradually start to introduce these things. So the movement, sort of what we say, developed gradually in the same way as giving more and more information, as people are more and more able to accept it. But you can't somehow or other lower the standard, because what about those who want to practice the highest standard? What about them? who enjoy the idea of practicing the principles on the way that the principles are meant to be practiced. So we, as they say, we don't discourage or even preach unnecessarily these things. Our movement is about attraction, not about aversion. So chanting Hare Krishna is attractive. Taking prasadam is attractive. Reading books, books on philosophy is attractive. Associating with devotees is attractive. And even doing many different types of service is attractive. So these are the things we encourage in the beginning, like that. And more also. But you can't say if one is not following the four regulative principles, they're not the devotee. They have room for improvement, but they're devotees. But for preaching, preaching means time, place, and circumstance, or prime, place, and candidate. You have to know your audience, like that. So a lot of times we have mixed audiences, so what do? Usually when mixed audiences, you talk to the persons on the lowest level. And everyone will benefit. That's how you're supposed to do. I didn't do that today. I just spoke the verse. But there are a class of people who want to become perfect in whatever they do. So when they hear about something that they have to do and they're not doing, they become inspired. There's a class of people like that. And then there's others that want spiritual life and material life at the same time. And so when they hear about things that restrict them in their material life, they get a little bit wobbly-kneed in their spiritual life. And they don't become discouraged. Therefore, we don't really push that. We say, you know, go for the higher task. Yes. Hare Keshava Prabhu. Is this a good play for this, you know, Dhruva killing the Yakshas? Is that a good one?
Maharaj, you already have said that about the celibacy part. I think Prabhupada never asked that what you did. He just set the standard very high and encouraged everyone to come to that. But one more thing about within the marriage, the sacred vow which you take during marriage is a higher principle than breaking this principle. No doubt it is. So I heard that it is not a sin, but it's an obstacle. But then breaking your sacred vows, as you said, that the husband will go away from her or go to a prostitute, that will be a greater sin. So keeping that in mind, we don't speak about it openly, but somewhere where we compromise in that principle is the sacred vow of marriage, that is a higher principle. If that is broken, it's a major type of a sin which a person has to.
So when there's two conflicting principles, the higher principle you're mentioning is the sacred vow of keeping the marriage together. Yeah. I also, when I get these questions, I also counsel people on that level too. Yeah. But then I say, you have something to work on. And so keep your vows, keep the relationship to go. And as Prabhupada, maybe using another example, when he was trying to discourage his new fledging devotees in the early days from smoking cigarettes, they would go to the programs, and then in between programs they'd go out and take a cigarette break and come back in. Prabhupada said, you may not be able to give it up, but that's all right. You should just pray to Krishna, my dear Lord, I wish I didn't have to do this. So if you have this consciousness where you realize that what you're doing is hurting your spiritual life, but you still can't give it up, You may continue, but with prayer. But your point is well taken, and it is something, I'm glad you brought that up. Because recently I gave initiation to one girl who wasn't following the four regulative principles. She wanted to follow, but her husband wasn't. I said, I'm going to give you initiation anyway because you've been waiting for so long, but try to work on that fourth regulative principle. And gradually, you know, she was able to do it. And she also strengthened her husband. Where, I don't know the situation now, but I think it's almost gone. So, yeah, keeping the marriage together is a higher principle. It's more sacred. Unless it becomes abusive. And then if it becomes abusive, then you might have to consider it something else. You know. You know what I mean by abusive. Where they're exploiting each other rather than developing the sanctimony of marriage. Then there's some consideration about some changes needed here.
So I have a question about initiation.
About?
Initiation.
Initiation.
If the husband is physically abusive and is aspiring to take initiation, if he's following regulative principles, like whatever standards are there, but physically abusive means this is a trend in India, like many times that is considered as a norm. Husband, if he...
There's a statement in the Garuda Purana, if you read it. It says there's six things you should be. But so, I won't mention that statement in the Garuda Purana. But people take shastras out of context and apply it in an abusive way. Yeah.
So is he eligible to take initiation? This is between Guru and him, but will the Guru accept him? Or that becomes a strong reason for him not to give initiation?
I would think there should be some counseling from the Guru to his disciple to explain that he has to change. Not that you reject it, but I mean, if we were rejecting everybody who wasn't qualified, then it wouldn't be much of a movement. So, therefore, part of our process is not only just following the dogmatic aspect of what is required to become initiated, but creating a dialogue and an environment where people who are aspiring for initiation can plug into something that they need to work on as they develop in their Krishna consciousness. So now, like nowadays, we have what is called premarital counseling sanghas, where grihasthas who are fixed in Krishna consciousness are counseling and inspiring other grihasthas to come up to the standard to become a good grihastha in Krishna consciousness. So these sanghas, we also have them for brahmacharis in some places also too. Before actually entering into the ashram, preparing yourself by, you know, various types of seminars and workshops. In other words, trying to uproot those things that are holding one person back. So I think it's starting to happen more and more in our society. It needs to be increased, of course. But simply like the old days was where you were in a temple and if you chanted 16 rounds for 6 months, you followed the four regulative principles, you were eligible for initiation. I think that's not enough nowadays. There should be some, what we say, what's the word? I can't think of the word. Some accountability as you're, you know, engaging in your... and preparing for initiation. So now we have more of an accountability and educational systems like that. So that has to be there. Not everyone can just anybody can follow four regulative principles for 6 months and chant 16 rounds. But then what happens when you're initiated? Are you able to maintain that throughout your whole life? We find a lot of cases, no. I don't want to make any quotes, but statistics are quite alarming in the other direction. So therefore, to prepare a person so he's strong once that initiation ceremony is formalized, all these other things should be exposed and dealt with, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's up to the leaders to come up with programs. And there are programs in the general sense, but there also have to be programs in the local. Every local area should have programs for helping people come to the standard of being qualified to become initiated. And also for ashrams too. Now even for sannyas ashram, there should be training to prepare. Now the period is, what is the training for sannyas ashram? Is that you have to travel with another sannyasi for 2 years now, and you also have to be on a waiting list for so many years. It wasn't like that in the old days, you know. In the old days, if you wanted sannyas, they would say, great, you're announced. Hey, that's good. Here's your stick. Go out and preach. But a lot of times it didn't work. But that wasn't the fault then, because that was the need of the time. Now it's changed. Now we have a social structure and we have a superstructure in place where we can facilitate more types of education and training. So I don't give initiation so easy anymore. I used to, but not no more. I make it tougher. People have to come up to a higher standard before they're actually ready for initiation. And also many of the other spiritual masters, even some of them have stopped giving initiation, and only in rare cases like that. Because they can see that people are not preparing themselves properly to come to that platform of initiation. So education is required, training is required, proper association is required, evaluations are required. Because the initiation is for life. It's not something you just, you know, go in and out of. So I agree with you, yeah. Your points are well taken, yeah. Mm-hmm. Anything else? Okay, thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.